course, it does affect jobs. But it isn't just the jobs, it's the military mission.
The Air Force makes job cuts on Alaska bases. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Providence excludes smokers from its hiring pool.
We are a healthcare institution, and we should be really being a great role model for our community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Military job cuts are being felt in Alaska. The Air Force has eliminated more than 250 jobs previously available to civilians at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Major Joseph Coslett, the base's public affairs director, says the cuts were ordered late yesterday as part of a national push to help meet an overall Air Force goal of more than 9,000 reductions. However, he says that does not mean there will be that many people who will lose their current jobs.
Identify 256 positions. Of those, 50 had folks in those current positions. Now, what our civilian personnel office is trying to do is move those folks to other open positions on the installation.
Coslett says the positions that will be eliminated were primarily the result of the merger of Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base into one joint operation. Major Coslett says despite the cuts, there are still some opportunities for civilians to work at the base, both with Air Force and Reserve units.
Some medical and some operational jobs or careers haven't been looked at yet because they directly support the warfighting capability. And so those are our mission partners here on J-Bear. And so maybe some of those folks that were identified could go that way. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to exhaust every voluntary measure we can. That way we don't have to do any involuntary reduction in force.
Alaska's other Air Force base is also affected by Department of Defense realignment and drawdown. Air Force spokesman Staff Sergeant Miguel Lara says Eielson, near Fairbanks, is also seeing civilian job losses.
Right now, Eielson's share of the resource management decision is at present 45 positions over the next 5 years. This doesn't directly translate into people. Some of the positions designated to be cut are currently empty or will be reallocated.
Lara says it's unclear exactly how many people will actually be laid off. He says a civilian hiring freeze remains in place as the base pursues voluntary cutbacks to try to avoid further mandated reductions. Congressman Don Young is calling the job cuts dead wrong. He says Alaska's congressional delegation is writing a letter stating concerns to Air Force Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz and Air Force Secretary Michael Donnelly.
What we have to do is try to, and we have a delegation letter we're sending over if we ever get the senators agreeing on anything. We're going to have a letter saying, no, this is wrong for the military mission. And, of course, it does affect jobs. But it isn't just the jobs, it's the military mission.
Young says he's concerned this could be a harbinger of what's to come someday when there's another round of BRAC or base realignment and closure when military installations around the country are examined for cuts.
That's the next danger we have in Alaska if this attitude keeps going. And I will tell you, if it gets to a point where I think we're not providing the appropriate training and equipment for my soldiers, I won't support any military. That's not fair to any troops that are in the military to have an inadequately trained soldier, male or female, inadequately equipped soldier. It's immoral for this Congress to send them possibly into combat.
There's no indication from the Obama administration that base closures are coming down the pike. Alaska needs improvement when it comes to after-school programs. That's according to a new report by a group that is working to ensure that all children have access to affordable, quality after-school programs. KDLG's Daisha Eaton explains.
The After School Alliance, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that's working to ensure that all children have access to after-school programs, and which published the report, gave Alaska a 2 on a scale of 1 to 5. 21 of the 50 states received a 1 or a 2. Jody Grant is the executive director of the After School Alliance. She says Alaska could be doing a lot better.
One of the challenges in Alaska is that it's harder to do these programs in rural areas. So one of the things we really need to do is, you know, at the federal policy level, direct more of our dollars and target more of our dollars to be efficiently used by rural communities. The biggest issues with rural area are recruitment and retention of after-school workers and transportation.
A significant body of research demonstrates that students who attend after-school programs regularly are more likely to improve their grades, test scores, and overall academic behavior. With Alaska's high dropout rate, nearly twice the national average, after-school programs might be something to take a look at, Grant says. The report examines how each state is supporting after-school programs by reviewing state policies, funding, and other activities and assessing the need in each state. Specifically, the State Progress Report considers participation in after-school programs based on data from the landmark 2009 America After 3 p.m. Household Survey. According to America After 3 p.m., 18% of school children in Alaska are in after-school programs. 40% are on their own in the afternoon. Grant says that number is concerning.
The hours between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. when parents aren't home are the ones when children are most likely to be victims or perpetrators of crime. It's when they're most likely to get into trouble. It's when they're most likely to participate in inappropriate activities. A second concern, a lot of kids are going home and they're popping on the computer or they're playing video games and they're isolated, it's not social, they're not being physically active, and none of that is necessarily ideal for them.
The America After 3 p.m. survey said lots of those kids would participate in after-school programs if they were available. Grant says both Alaska senators have been supportive of improving the after-school situation in the state.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Senator Murkowski is one of our greatest champions in the Senate. She has been really leading the effort, along with Senator Barbara Boxer of California, to create more after-school opportunities for children across the nation. And Senator Begich has been a very big supporter, too.
In terms of policy activity and funding, Alaska met one of five criteria set forth by the After School Alliance. However, it failed to meet criteria such as a state initiative promoting quality after-school programming. But Grant says that as far as the after-school programs that are in Alaska already, parents think they're great.
95% of parents are satisfied with their after-school programs, which is huge. So the programs in Alaska that are running are doing something right.
Grant says there just needs to be more of them to serve the 40% of children who are still on their own after school in Alaska. Nationwide, more than 15 million school-age children, more than 1 in 4 kids in the U.S. are unsupervised after the school day ends. The parents of 18 million school children say they would enroll their kids in after-school programs if they were available. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Every year, the Alaska Department of Labor devotes one monthly report entirely to fisheries issues. They run the data on how many people the fishing industry employs and how much revenue it brings in. The report found that the number of people commercially harvesting fish has gone down over the past 5 years. In 2005, the monthly employment average was about 7,500 people. Last year, it was under 7,000. Rob Crayer was one of the economists who helped put together the report. He's not quite sure why this decline happened. He says that the department didn't examine potential causes like the national economic downturn or the implementation of Alaska-specific fisheries policies like rationalization.
You know, it certainly might be an external factor which affects things, but I couldn't say if it was a driving force or not.
Crager did point out that the amount of money Alaska's fisheries bring in had gone up in the past few years. The total dockside value of the state's fisheries last year was $1.6 billion. The Aleutian and Pribilof Island region was the most productive area, contributing $473 million to that amount. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating the life's work of a Juno entertainer.
I guess it all centers around making people happy, and that's kind of what I've given myself as a job in life, is to make people's lives a little bit better, just making their lives just a little bit easier to live.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Providence Alaska Medical Center and its affiliates around the state will stop hiring tobacco users as of November 17th. The healthcare provider will begin testing prospective employees for nicotine along with illegal drugs. Tammy Green is Director of Health Management Services for Providence Health and Services Alaska. She says it's not a decision the company made overnight.
We're like any other organization. We were starting to see our own healthcare costs escalating at an unsustainable trend. And so we wanted to take action, and we've been on this journey for 3 years. And in that journey, we really started to see what was happening nationally and other, you know, really forward thinkers in healthcare. And Cleveland Clinic is one of the, you know, premier healthcare systems in the world. And in 2007, they made the decision to stop hiring tobacco users. So I spent the last year really investigating, researching, looking at several other companies and organizations who have done this as well, and vetted it through our executives, and everybody thought this is a great idea. You know, we are a healthcare institution, and we should be really being a great role model for our community.
How do you think this will affect the workplace environment at Providence?
Well, you know, to be very clear, this is only for new hires, people applying to work for Providence on or after November 17th, which, by the way, is Great American Smokeout Day. The current employees are not impacted at all. You know, one of the upsides is that potentially our current employees who may be tobacco users, you know, may be encouraged or want to look at the resources we have to stop smoking or using tobacco themselves, but there's no pressure or anything on our current employees.
And what about other Providence facilities in other states?
At this time, this is only an Alaska region effort. And we know our sister ministries are all looking to see what happens and how this will play out. But we've really been the leader in lots of things for our system in terms of health and well-being with our employees. So we're really excited to have this opportunity to really kind of invite the conversation in our community about why this is important.
What kind of reaction have you had and heard about the decision?
All kinds of reaction. You know, we've had lots of positive reaction from, you know, patients and other folks in our community. We've obviously had reaction concern from our employees wondering, you know, what about us? What's next? You know, we've been very clear, or we've tried to say that this is not about our current employees. But we've also had, you know, concern that, you know, how can Providence do this, and is it legal? And yes, it is legal in Alaska. There are some states where you couldn't do this, but in Alaska, it is legal. And Alaska Airlines has been doing this since the 80s. So, you know, we're certainly not the first to step forward, but we do know that we are making a pretty big line in the sand, so to speak, since we are the largest private employer, and we are healthcare.
Tammy Green is Director of Health Management Services for Providence in Alaska. The creation of a fund specifically intended to improve rural internet service seems like it would be a good thing for Alaska. But the decision is less than popular with Alaska's telecommunications companies. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
Slow internet and outdated wireless data coverage are facts of life for many Alaskan communities. That might be about to change, though. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission dedicated a $4.5 billion subsidy fund to providing broadband and 3G access in rural areas. In the past, the Universal Service Fund was used to subsidize rural telephone usage. Now the FCC has renamed it the Connect America Fund and expanded its mission to ensuring broadband access in remote areas. Here's FCC spokesperson Mark Wigfield.
These reforms are designed to get affordable, robust broadband to areas of rural America that need support to get that, where without some support, there wouldn't be a business case for a private company to do that.
Currently, only 75% of Alaskans have access to what the FCC considers broadband internet, mostly in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. The ruling requires telecommunications companies to upgrade internet service for the remaining 155,000 residents in order to continue receiving subsidies. Many companies oppose the decision, saying it takes vital funding out of the state. In 2010, Alaska Telecoms received more than $200 million in subsidies through the fund. By some estimates, they stand to lose three-quarters of that money over the next 5 years under the new plan. One of the biggest concerns raised by companies is how they'll pay off infrastructure investments that were made to support telephone service while accommodating the additional expense of providing broadband. ADAC Eagle Enterprises is the telephone provider for the Aleutian community of ADAC. Chief Operations Officer Andalia Weaver says the ruling puts her company in jeopardy.
So right now, you know, we don't even know what we're going to look like 3 years from now. Our forecast, based off of this ruling, we won't even be in business.
Weaver says the FCC hasn't taken into account the technological hurdles that make service in rural Alaska expensive.
They don't understand that there is no fiber in the ground that connects ADAC to Anchorage. It's all backhaul from satellites.
She says the ruling means purchasing more satellite bandwidth with less funding. In particular, she bristled at a new spending cap of $3,000 a year per line. In 2010, ADAC Enterprises received almost $17,000 in subsidies per line to operate their network. FCC spokesperson Mark Wigfield says the ruling does take into account areas like ADAC.
You know, we also recognize that some areas are very costly to serve, so there is a waiver process that we provided for areas where costs are really going to be above and beyond that benchmark.
And Alaska Senator Mark Begich says the final ruling strikes a balance between accountability and opportunity.
The FCC, I think, feels better about how the money will be deployed in the most difficult and expensive areas. And the companies are being responsive by recognizing that we got to move some of the resource from the urban area to the more rural areas where we really need to get this broadband backbone built.
So far, only a 7-page executive summary of the ruling has been released. When the final document is published in coming weeks, it's expected to be more than 500 pages long and will likely address in much greater detail how the program is going to affect Alaska's telecommunications. In on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A Juneau artist, musician, and entertainer was recently recognized for his lifetime achievements as part of the Governor's Awards for the Arts. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld takes a look at Jeff Brown's life and work.
Here's what Jeff Brown sounds like when he's entertaining kids.
The great trick is when I'm going to attempt to move the sun from the box to the sky using my special magical powers, and I'm going to do it on the count of three. One, two, three. Alaska Deborah.
Or making balloon animals.
Here you are, to see if it fits. It fits!
Or running for mayor in a monkey suit.
Why vote? You know, vote for Gorilla. Who else?
Brown, a longtime Alaskan, also produces radio shows, writes how-to books, puts out parody postcards and publications, volunteers with community groups. The list goes on.
Where does he come up with those ideas?
That's Juno Arts and Humanities Council Executive Director Nancy DeCherney.
I don't think there's anybody in this town that can summarize everything that Jeff did.
But let's try. Brown says it all started in high school when he heard the experimental comedy group Fire Sign Theater.
They made it possible for me to think that it would be possible itself to go to a radio station and start volunteering.
He moved to Juneau as a Coast Guard medic in 1975. Soon, he came across fledgling public radio station KTOO.
And they were having a fundraising marathon, and I said, can I help out? And they said, sure. And then they asked for volunteers to be on the radio, and I said, sure. And I've been saying yes ever since.
Brown went on to work for the station and its TV affiliate. He also became a key member of an improvisational theater group, a historical play for tourists, and a news parody show. As time passed, he also became a recognized artist, working with stained glass, manipulated photographs, and assembled found objects. He's even created museum exhibits of Alaska mazes and board games.
He's one of those rare individuals that seem to have no boundaries in regard to medium.
Bob Banghart is chief curator of the Alaska State Museums. He's also a musician and founder of the Alaska Folk Festival, another place Brown has been active.
At any various year, he was engaged in setting together programming, doing the newsletter, organizing the workshops, organizing the MCs, or being the MC, or being on stage playing. I mean, he's done everything there is to do, probably with the exception of selling hot dogs, but we've never sold hot dogs.
Then there's the kid-focused efforts. Brown's produced a nationally distributed children's radio program, toured an Alaska magic show, and was half of the kids' music duo, The Wigglers. One of Brown's most recent efforts has been Real Alaskan magazine. The 64-page, full-color, glossy humor publication parodies images and stories from the North. He says people have been more than willing to help.
I can call up somebody in Sitka and I could say, will you find a couple of ballet students and put them up in tutus and rubber boots and have them posing at Swan Lake? And they said, sure, no problem.
Brown's Lifetime Achievement Award comes at a time when he's having to slow down. He has Parkinson's disease, a brain disorder that causes shaking, stuttering, and makes movement difficult. But he's still being creative.
I can do the same things that I've done before. It just takes a lot longer. Mm-hmm. It's kind of discouraging that way, but it's one of those things you just have to muscle through.
He's a little self-conscious about the Lifetime Achievement Arts Award and says lots of other people have done as much or more. And it hasn't changed his goal.
I guess it all centers around making people happy, and that's kind of what I've given myself as a job in life, is to make people's lives a little bit better, or making them laugh or making them smile, just making their lives just a little bit easier to live.
One, stare into my eyes. Two and a quarter. 2 7/8. 2 15/16.
And 3, and it's gone completely from the box. Ladies and gentlemen, that's my version of Raven seeing the daylight from the box. Thank you.
This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaskans live in many different kinds of creative structures. Reporter Diana Savrin recently traveled across the state, taking shelter in everything from a converted garbage shed to a wall tent. She also found yurts, lots of yurts. And as Savrin reports, there's a lot more to living in a circle than might appear at first glance.
This is the yoga yurt.
When Haynes resident Beth McCready refers to her yoga yurt, she's distinguishing it from the others on her property. It's one of three. Beth discovered yurts as lightweight, low-cost housing many years back and has been hooked ever since. The vinyl roof amplifies the sound of rain and makes it very portable.
Sounds good. Yeah. So is this like for the community, yoga and this?
Yeah, anyone can use this, actually. It's open.
Beth is not alone in her enthusiasm. We met yurt dwellers in Homer, Seldovia, Fairbanks, McCarthy, and Healy. And yurts have even made their way as far as Nome and Coldfoot. Jessica Tenoff manufactures yurts in Homer for her company, Nomad Shelter. From her perspective, it's no surprise that yurts have spread so widely, so quickly.
Well, this will load in a small pickup. Not a big pickup, but small pickup. Or a skiff, or a snow machine sled. We've brought this size of yurt 100 miles north of Nome on a snow machine.
That's part of their charm. They're mobile. And once set up, they can easily fold back down. Jessica and others have adapted this ancient structure for use in North America. But there are challenges to living in a big circular room, Jessica admits. There are no corners to slip away in.
My son right now is up in Nome, and he shipped his yurt up there to live in because he's suction dredging off the coast of Nome. And he has a partner who's a woman, and they're not together and living together in the same space.
It's not just roommates who find it challenging to share space. Hig Hegman and Aaron McKittrick live in Seldovia in a 24-foot diameter yurt with their two small children, Latuya and Katmai.
Do you like having the whole family sort of in one room?
Yeah, I think most of the time it works really well. There are occasional times when I, wish that Katmai waking up didn't wake Latuya up or banged your head. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there definitely are compromises. There's time, yeah, just like Aaron's saying, there's times when you're like, wow, I see why people have multiple rooms in their house, you know?
Aaron and Higgs' yurt sits perched on a plywood platform. The walls are white, checkered with wood lattice. A small wood stove sits in the middle of the yurt, which they say is enough to keep them warm in the winter. There are certainly challenges with having everything in one room, especially because they also work from home, or work from yurt. Areas to sleep, play, work, and cook are merged together, with laptops on kitchen counters, blankets around the table, and toys just about everywhere. In Fairbanks, Amber Heard and her boyfriend Arash Peshin have a less chaotic version of the same thing. Amber is an anthropologist, and living in a yurt has tickled her notion of how humans navigate space.
You do kind of like create this mental space where, okay, I am now in the kitchen, he'll be in the office, or, you know, like, since we can't do it with walls, we just kind of
do it with
headsets.
These small commutes from mental dining room to office to bedroom make the space cozy for some families. But others use yurts to spread out even more. In Haines, newly elected mayor Stephanie Scott let her kids have their own yurts in their backyard.
After we built our larger house and were no longer living in the yurt, we turned it over to our teenagers for whatever recreation they decided to pursue because I wanted my kids to stay at home. And they used it vigorously.
Stephanie built her own wooden yurt when she first came to Alaska and later replaced it with a yurt purchased from an Oregon company. Now that her kids have grown up, she sold the yurt, but she says she misses it. For APRN, and with help from Jonathan Christ Tompkins, this is Diana Savrin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Alexandra Gutierrez and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Diana Savrin in yurts across the state. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.